Lights out on the hour. It is the hour of the time. Lights out for the curfew of your body, soul, and mind.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, tonight, 12th January 2010. Now I want to thank all of you for tuning in. I hope you take your studious notes and pay attention. That hasn't been happening a lot lately, so please take notes. We're going to start a new series this evening, ladies and gentlemen. One that I had actually done years ago. It took me a month of prep time to get ready for it from various authentic works, taking everything from the sources that spread these various beliefs on the topic matter. And unfortunately, through all 10 hours, WBCQ forgot to record it. So we are going to make up for that. It had been asked for quite a bit. That was back in 05, I believe. And go over that series again. Many people are lacking in this background information and what a lot of these societies actually think and believe and preach. And that will help you better understand their agendas, their goals, their time frames, etc. Now, first, the cursory information. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com. That's hourofthetime.com. The studio number in Arizona, 928-333-2942. In Canada, 613-733-4324. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of you are finally seem to be kicking, I should say 50% of you seem to be kicking in with my warnings and advice on how to leave a phone message. And for that 50% of you, it's much appreciated. Getting to the point, your name, what was the inquiry, and a return phone number if I'm not available at the time. The other half of you are still blah, blah, blah. So I just erase them. I told you I would, and I will. Now, ladies and gentlemen, also, throughout this series, we'll still be taking audience input for future broadcast live on the Hour of the Time. So if you have a certain topic matter that you are unclear about, that you think we've covered in the past, you'd like some refresher on it, to go with the past research and work we've already done, then go ahead and email me, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and we'll see what we can do to accommodate your inquiries. Also, don't forget, Hour of the Time is listener supported. Ladies and gentlemen, without your support via donations for broadcast, MP3 series, whole collections, books, DVDs, we cannot maintain the bandwidth, shopping carts, email inquiries, travel, research, lights, phones, broadcasting. You get the hint. And we have some offers right now to go on every day of the week on television, satellite television. And unless we hear and see some serious feedback, I'm not even going to jump into it and then have Rob and myself hawking ourselves to pay off the debts, as we've done so many times in the past. Now, people have been asking about the Pennsylvania conference still, and still, it's open. So if you'd like to attend, email me, hourthetime@hotmail.com, and we can do that. Also, I need input about the Kansas City conference. It would be in the May, June, or end of August areas. We have three slots, basically, that we're looking at right now. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your last call to give me input on Kansas City. Is it you? Is it you and a spouse? Is it you and a son? Is it you and five coworkers? We need to know that to make final plans. Again, you can call the studio number about that, 928-333-2942. For the Kansas City Conference, scheduled tentatively for midsummer, I'll call it, of this year. Or you can email me, hourthetime@hotmail.com. Now, as always, have something to take notes with. A lot of people have not been taking notes. I can totally prove it by the questions and comments in the chat rooms and emails and phone messages I'm getting. And I am getting also sick of repeating stuff that we've taken the time to research, document, and give to you. The bottle's going to be cut off pretty soon, ladies and gentlemen. And some of you are going to have to grow up, take notes, donate for the MP3s, what have you. I don't care what method. But quit having us spin our wheels repeating stuff because you choose to take a lackadaisical attitude towards these broadcast letters, list, information, classes, what have you. So after this musical break, be prepared for part one this evening of the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid. right, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with the Hour of the Time. The website, hourofthetime.com, and my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, studio number 928-333-2942 in Arizona, and 613-733-4324 in the Canadian studio. Now, ladies and gentlemen, many of you, hopefully, listening to the Hour of the Time for some period, will recognize such works as Rosicrucian Principles for the Home and Business, Mansions of the Soul, and maybe even more so these titles, A Thousand Years of Yesterdays and the Mystical Life of Jesus. Probably the last one you'll be recognized more so than anything. When discussing the mysteries and their writings and beliefs and propaganda and agendas for our country, for all countries, for the world, for the future, it's best to go to the source works themselves, ladies and gentlemen. The symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid has often been overlooked by the same author, Mr. Lewis, Ph.D. Now, we've covered the Rosicrucians at depth here on the Hour of the Time. And again, if you need that information, you could certainly order the MP3 collection of Mystery Babylon 1, 2, or 3, the Lost Light series, etc. Or this series when it's completed. Ladies and gentlemen, it's especially critical because there's so much propaganda out there involving the secret societies and their influence to go to the source material. And, in fact, I will read the preface, the premise as well of this work from Mr. Lewis. Because even he saw that very thing at the time of this writing. It's a very, very old book. I'm holding it in my hand right now and going to read from it. There have been so many books and pamphlets written about the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt that it would seem that one more on the subject would be useless. The great divergency of opinions expressed in these books would tend to lead the researchers of them and readers of them to feel that each new book is but another presentation of personal opinions, and that the multiplicity of opinions leaves the seeker for truth greatly puzzled. After all, any description of the pyramid is like a description of a beautiful sunset or of a magnificent painting. Each description is a slightly different picture of what is in the eyes of the beholder. Those who would benefit by such descriptions must take from each other what seems to be in agreement with the others and what creates in their minds a logical conception. Certain it is that the pyramid in toto can be described from many different viewpoints. The architect, the structural engineer, the builder, the laborer, the artist, and the artisan will find in the pyramid elements to hold their attention, command admiration and respect, and furnish material for elaborate and enthusiastic descriptions. Then there are the historian, the philosopher, the scientist, and the mystic. Each of them will find in the pyramid that which he can admire and dwell upon with ecstasy, enthusiasm, or cold, mechanical respect. The thesis of this presentation is the very presentation of the mystical side of the pyramid, and the support of the contention presented in many ancient traditions that the Great Pyramid was built not as a tomb for a king who sought to aggrandize himself immediately before and long after his transition, but as a place designed entirely and used exclusively for mystical ceremonies of initiation and, incidentally or coincidentally, as a monument for the preservation of wisdom and to be everlasting, a prophet of the future. Ladies and gentlemen, again, the presentation of the mystical side of the pyramid and the support of the contention presented in many ancient traditions that the Great Pyramid was built not as a tomb for a king who sought to aggrandize himself immediately before and long after his transition, but as a place designed entirely and used exclusively for mystical ceremonies of initiation, and to be everlastingly a prophet of the future. For this reason, ladies and gentlemen, this presentation does not deal exhaustively with the mechanical, engineering, scientific, or other features of the design and structure of the pyramid, except insofar as they cast light upon its mystical symbolism and its practical usefulness in accordance with the thesis referred to. Even the so-called religious side of its significance is touched upon but lightly, because many other books have elaborated upon this phase of the subject, often to fanatical extremes. It is oft too easy to go astray and allow one's imagination and fancy to associate many things found in the pyramid with statements to be found in the Christian Bible in both the Old and New Testaments. This is not due to the fact that there are so many doubtful or unproved elements to be found in the pyramid, which may be explained by extreme resort to the imagination, but to the fact that so many pages in the Christian Bible are susceptible of various explanations and interpretations, often through elaborate discussions of the precise meaning of some word in a sentence, regardless of the fact that many such words were arbitrarily chosen by the interpreters and translators of the Bible without having in mind the unique application that might be made of the shades of meaning attributed to such words. Because in ancient writings we find references to the four corners of the earth, we should not assume that the original writers of the words, not the translators or interpreters, intended to imply that the earth was square and actually had four corners. But such phrases easily lend themselves to the fanatical modern interpreters in writing about the Great Pyramid, who would argue that the pyramid represents the squareness of the earth and that in the beginning of time the earth must have been square because the Bible speaks of the four corners of the earth and the pyramid itself has four corners. The same is true in regard to the manner of interpreting many of the prophetic indications in the pyramid to incidents related in the Bible. By a little stretch of the imagination and the assistance upon certain shades of meaning attributed to words describing the life and acts of Jesus, the extremist would have us believe that every incident in the life of Jesus is prophesied in the pyramid, and that the future life of man, as outlined in the Christian dogmas and creeds, is firmly established in the predictions found in the pyramid. This, ladies and gentlemen, would make the pyramid exclusively a Christian monument, which must have been, therefore, designed and created by Christians to emphasize the Christian religion and to intimate that only Christians would find wisdom in its revelations. the fact, ladies and gentlemen, that the pyramid was designed and built long before the Christian doctrines were presented to man is no embarrassment to these extremists who explain this difficulty by stating that the designers and creators of the pyramid knew in advance of the coming of Jesus the Christ, the teachings he would present, the acts he would perform, and the eventual Christianizing of the entire world by, quote, the only true religion, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lewis, excuse me, has chosen to lead the individual readers of this book and his presentations the personal choice of making such religious interpretations. And the decision as to whether or not the Great Pyramid prophesizes the Christianizing of the whole world. This is a matter that is entirely outside the scope of this present work. Mr. Lewis visited the inside and outside of the pyramid, and he studied many plans of its measurements and delineation, and examined for many years ancient and modern records containing the old traditions and the present secret writings and reports regarding the original purpose of the pyramid and its occupation and use. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, most of the statements made in this presentation are not the mere personal opinions of the author, but the personal opinions of multitudes of persons who have been in contact with those associated with the pyramid in the time of its mystical use, or who have made recent studies of its present conditions. The opinions of some modern writers, scientists, and investigators have been added in support of the ancient traditions and findings. This presentation from Mr. Lewis, therefore, is a handbook of the mystical side of the Great Pyramid and argues its thesis from the premise of many established facts. If any listener out there desires to adopt an opposing opinion and to insist that the Great Pyramid of Giza was not what this thesis claims, he is entitled to his opinion, and the burden of proof rests upon him to support his contentions and at the same time exhaust himself in attempting to negate the outstanding facts, well established, which support the ideas presented in this presentation. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we'll move on to the first section of his presentation. And you might find this of great interest. I hope you're taking notes. And there'll be lots of little key words dropped here and there out of his presentation. I'm going to use their material throughout and, as well, look back to other works like, for instance, the mystical life of Jesus. The Great Pyramid of Egypt, aside from its prophecies or any of its secret purposes, is one of the world's great mysteries. For ages, the Great Pyramid has been surrounded by mysterious traditions which have beclouded the mind of every researcher and made the work of every scientific investigator extremely difficult. There are several ways in which the investigator may approach the subject of the pyramid, from the historical, the architectural, the mystical, and the religious and prophetic. In each of these approaches, the field widens and the horizon becomes more and more distant as one attempts to reach the goal of ultimate understanding and comprehension. It would almost seem that with the coming of the dawn of civilization, the mystery of the pyramid was already a topic of world interest and world discussion, keeping in mind that at that time the world was limited to an area practically surrounding the pyramid itself. The earliest historians of the civilizations of man referred to the pyramid, each viewing the huge structure from different viewpoints, and each stressing his comprehension of its significance. It is little wonder, therefore, that even today, with any of the light that has been cast upon the pyramid, it is still a mystery, and that a complete comprehension of it appears to be as far away as in the days when Western world civilization first gazed upon it and attempted to pierce the veil of mystery which surrounded it. Let us start with its name as a beginning. The ancient Egyptians were impressed not so much by any secret or religious significance attached to it, or by the size of its base, as they were by its enormous height. Even today, tourists from the Western world and those accustomed to viewing the extreme heights of modern skyscrapers with their 50 or more towering stories are strangely impressed by the height of the Great Pyramid. And it is for this reason the Egyptians chose for a name for the structure a term that expressed their appreciation of its heights rather than its dimensions in the other way. The Egyptian word pyramus meant to them something of great vertical height. From this, the Greek pyramus, or the plural pyramides, was formed. After the 17th century, the English language adopted the singular form pyramid. It must be kept in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that there are a number of pyramids in Egypt, and that most popular references to the pyramid are to the so-called Great Pyramid, the largest of all. Many tourists from the Western world, and especially from America, are surprised when they tour through Egypt to find that the pyramid, which has always held a fascination for them, is but one of a number. The second surprise comes when they have their first glimpse of this great pyramid from some rooftop or one of the garrison places of Cairo. The Great Pyramid then appears to be but a small structure indeed, and unworthy of all of the magnificent terms applied to it. As tourists go by trolley car or automobile towards the famous Mena House on the outskirts of Cairo, and then mount camels to take a fascinating zigzagging journey to the pyramid itself, the expressions of disappointment on the faces of the tourist are a testimony of the high esteem in which the pyramid is held in the minds and the imaginations of those who have never seen it. Set out in the desert sands, separated from any other large structures or any part of the city itself, and even without trees close to it for comparison, the Great Pyramid looks like a toy. This is an optical illusion due to two fundamental and interesting principles. First, the absence of any other structure of common size nearby makes it impossible for the human mind to realize its splendor and magnificence in height or width. One cannot tell at first glance whether the pyramid is the equivalent of a, say, three-story structure, such as one would see in almost any Western world, village or town, or something of 10 or more stories in height. Secondly, the unusually clear atmosphere of Egypt, especially in the winter months, when tourists most frequent that part of the world, robs all landscape views of that strange atmospheric softness, which gives us a sense of perspective and distance. Buildings and monuments in Egypt a mile distant appear as sharp in detail as those a few hundred feet away. Persons from the Western world are accustomed to seeing a violet or blue haze tint, the distant trees, mountains, and structures, in such a manner as to indicate the distance between objects and the viewer. And by the token of this atmospheric softness, we appreciate not only the distance, but the real height of the object viewed. Looking at the pyramid from the Mena house, it would appear to be not more than 1/4 mile distant because of the sharpness of detail and the absence of any atmospheric haze. Judging its height, then, as something that is only 1/4 mile away, it appears low and small indeed. But as one continues to ride upon the camel, the discovery is made that minute after minute passes without any apparent decrease in the distance between the viewer and the pyramid. The length of that ride is another surprise, for it takes much longer than the mind imagines, and it is only when the rider and the camel are practically within the shadow of the pyramid and the eyes are turned upward towards its apex that one realizes its tremendous height. And then the camel, the rider, and the native guide appear like pygmies, like little grains of sand in comparison to the pyramid itself. All right, ladies and gentlemen, your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, 12th January 2010, part one in the symbolic prophecy of the Great Pyramid. The website, hourofthetime.com. My personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. The studio number in Eager, 928-333-2942. And the Canadian studio, 613-733-4324. Now to continue with Mr. Lewis. One of the first mysteries of the traditions of the pyramid, found in all of the ancient records, and still a basis for the accumulation of mysterious traditions that have grown around the pyramid in the past centuries, is the fact that the pyramid, in form and nature, in architectural and mechanical design, in location and appearance, usefulness, and mathematical calculation, is symbolical of so many things that the list seems almost endless. The early Egyptians themselves discovered that its very form was not only familiar in some way, but suggestive of the laws of nature, for they had seen in specimens of rock, in mineral elements, and even in some grains of sand, the crystalline formations that were based upon the triangle or the form of the pyramid. We know today that there are many elements in the earth that are triangular or pyramidal in crystal formation, and that the pyramid and the triangle are fundamental manifestations of some underlying principle of creation. The early Egyptians were intellectually divided into two classes, those who were enslaved by the superstitious teachings of the priesthood, and those who were enlightened by the great truths of the mystery schools. In both classes, however, there are those who were familiar by casual observation with certain fundamental laws of nature, and they sought the exemplification and manifestation of these fundamental laws in all of nature. For this reason, the very form of the pyramid as a unit in structure aroused in the minds a realization that the pyramid was in some way associated with something fundamental in the creation of the universe. And among both classes of the earliest civilized Egyptians, there was an appreciation of the fact that the triangle represented symbolically and mathematically a divine law or a cosmic law. Those who were steeped in superstition looked upon the triangle as an emblem of either white or black magic, while those among the illuminated ones in the mystery schools expressed the equation of divine law with the triangle and reverenced it as a sacred triangle of divine principles. Without doubt, the triangle was the earliest form of sacred symbolism among the intelligent of Egypt, and a symbol of superstitious practices among the ignorant. While the square or cube was a worldly or mundane symbol, devoid of sacredness but paramount in its physical strength. When it dawned upon these early Egyptians that the pyramid was really four triangles superimposed upon a square, the combination of symbolism thus made manifest awakened a new interest in the pyramid and gave birth to more mysterious traditions regarding the pyramid's purpose and its origins. except those Egyptians who participated in its building and the generation which immediately followed its completion. All other generations of Egyptians looked upon the pyramid as something very old and eternally existent. To the illuminated ones, the historical records preserved in the pyramid itself, which they were permitted to visit by virtue of their association with the mystery schools and other records maintained in the various mystery temples, revealed the truth of the origin and purpose of the pyramid. But to the uninitiated, stressed, ladies and gentlemen, by author, not myself, but to the uninitiated, the ignorant, and the devotees of the priesthood, the intimation so carefully worded and significantly offered became the traditional laws of their beliefs. To them, the fact that the similarity between the fundamental crystal structure of earthly elements and the fundamental principle of the triangle and square were things of the eternal plan and had their origin with the beginning of the universe, indicated to them that the pyramid mud must have existed from all time. For this reason, ladies and gentlemen, the traditions so prevalent among the ignorant of Egypt, which constituted the large majority and which became elaborately interwoven in all of the extensive literature or cultural thoughts of Egypt, are filled with stories regarding the age, the antiquity, the origin, and purpose of this old structure. This was indeed a problem to the earliest investigators and the earliest historians who attempted to fathom the mysteries of the pyramid. Until the pyramid was actually entered by the profane world, until the pyramid was actually entered by the profane world, represented by inquiring scientists, the only established reports or stories of the pyramid were those which traced the origin of the pyramid to various kings whose periods and identities were unknown, or to deified personages of great antiquity. To get to the truth of the origin and purpose of the pyramid was, therefore, a most difficult matter, because some of the other pyramids, smaller in size, and unlike the Great Pyramid in outer finish and interior arrangement, had been built as tombs for kings or monuments to their burial, it was logically believed by the uneducated Egyptians that the Great Pyramid was just another tomb for a king that was greater than any of his predecessors. This idea of the pyramid being a tomb was so firmly fixed in the minds of the Egyptian populace at the time of the earliest investigations that it would have been almost like a sacrilege to have dared to say to any of the natives or even their rulers and leaders that the Great Pyramid was something other than a mere monument to personal vanity. We note today from a study of architecture alone that such structures as pyramids began in the middle period of Egyptian history, or during the period from the 4th to the 12th dynasty. Prior to the building of the Great Pyramid, when small pyramids were built as tombs, a square chamber or an oblong chamber was sunk in the dry sand of Egypt, generally at a place where the inundations of the Nile would not reach the site. And here the sunken chamber was lined with stone, painted or decorated with symbols appropriate to the political position of the deceased, and descriptive of the historical events of the time. It was then covered over with a roof to protect it, and upon the site was built a pyramid slightly larger in its base than the underground tomb. This sort of burial place, ladies and gentlemen, was an advancement over the former type, in which case the underground tomb was covered either with stone or with piles of brushwood interwoven with stone or reeds of grass plastered with thick mud and then covered with sand. The passing of years, however, proved that such tombs would not afford the eternal protection that was hoped for. Following the period when pyramid building was popular, it was discovered that the enormous cost involved in building pyramids might be saved by building stone roofs over the sunken chambers, or with small temple or chapel chambers above them, affording protection to the chamber beneath. Many of this type were built, but the shifting of the sand soon covered them up, or the sandstorms of many ages cut deeply into the structures that rose above the sand and destroyed them. And it is only in recent years that many of these underground tombs have been discovered. It may be interesting at this point, ladies and gentlemen, to describe to the reader something of the nature of these sandstorms, and how and why so many of the magnificent structures of Egypt gradually disappeared from sight and in more recent years had to be excavated. Upon Mr. Lewis's first visit to Egypt, he discovered that the primitive make of automobile, which was put in an open space at Luxor, Egypt, directly across the Nile from the Valley of the Kings, where the tombs of ancient Thebes are located, soon became covered with a layer of sand. The sandstorms from the Sahara Desert, blowing eastward along the Nile toward the eastern horizon, carry the sands at certain periods of the year in huge clouds across the vacuum space of the Nile, and allow the sands to settle on the eastern banks. In 7 days' time, the sand deposited on the automobile was over an eighth of an inch in thickness. Such storms continuing month after month, year after year, and century after century, deposited mountains of sand in various places along the Nile, until the sand was over the tops of the highest structures and temples. The temples of Luxor and Karnak themselves were at one time beneath the sands. And even in the years 1900 to 1920, there were portions of Luxor upon which native mud houses had been built without any suspicion that beneath such primitive homes there existed huge temples. The columns of the temple of Luxor, over 80 feet in height, were at one time entirely beneath the surface of the sands that had accumulated, and all of this had to be removed basketful by basketful to unearth and uncover the magnificent temples beneath. It must be kept in mind also that the civilization or population of Egypt centered itself on a long, narrow strip of land from Alexandria to the mountain regions in the south along either side of the Nile River. This was because agriculture had to be confined to the banks of the Nile. At certain periods of each year, the waters rose in abundance, overflowed the low banks, and inundated the land to a certain narrow distance on either side. Here, then, were built all of the habitations and native villages, and here all of the agriculture of the country was confined. All temples and edifices, such as homes or schools, were built farther away from the Nile, generally towards the west, so as not to usurp any of the valuable fertile land near the river, which was needed for agricultural purposes. Along most portions of the Nile, the eastern bank rises abruptly to a great height, principally because of the sandstorms which carried sands across the river and deposited them on the eastern side. Today, the Nile River at Luxor and at many other points is many feet below the surface of the roadway that was built along the bank. And above this roadway tower the columns of temples 70 to 85 feet high. Yet these too were at one time deeply buried beneath the sand. At the northern end of the Nile River, where it has its outlet into the Mediterranean Sea, is the famous delta, a triangular-shaped piece of swampland interspersed with natural and man-made canals and rivulets, constituting one of the most fertile sections of Egypt. And in ancient times, this was the site of many of the earliest habitations. Heliopolis, the great mystical city, which is three towering obelisks, was just north of Cairo. Now, about 30 minutes ride by trolley or automobile. Only one of the obelisks now remains to mark the site of the ancient city adjoining, which has the largest hotel and modern tourist playground in the world. Many of the most beautiful of the columns and architectural features of ancient temples have been cut and whipped by the blowing sands, which in most cases have thinned the columns to mere skeleton form, or carved the great stones into small pieces. It is for this reason that the sides of the Great Pyramid, those facing the most general sandstorms, have been lashed so greatly in the past century that the outer casing, a smooth and magnificent finish, has been cut away, leaving to view the crude underblocks of stone. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to your host here, Doyle Shamley, on the Hour of the Time, 12th of January 2010, with part one in our series. The website, hourofthetime.com, my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Studio number in Canada, 613-733-4324, and in Eager, 928-333-2942. Our mailing address, Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. And again, my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just a few more quick reminders before we wrap up this evening. The Pennsylvania Conference is still open. You can go to the website, hourofthetime.com, or the Hot Shot via the website, and look at payment schedules, etc. It's all there. If you are interested in the Kansas City Conference, I need to hear from you before we commit to a final week. We're looking at the summer, midsummer, if you will, mid-year this year in Kansas City proper. Right outside, but Kansas City. Let me know at hourofthetime@hotmail.com or the studio number 928-333-2942. Also, ladies and gentlemen, remember we are listener supported, and a great accoutrement to this series that we're into right now, just starting this evening, would be the Lost Light series. It's available via the Hot Shop and our website, hourofthetime.com, in an MP3 package. And who knows, you might just learn a thing or two, ladies and gentlemen. Now, tomorrow evening we will continue. No, we won't, actually. I believe tomorrow evening Robert is interviewing the gentleman behind O Canada. But if that falls through, if they're unable to make the schedule, Rob has put a lot of work into this. We have the DVDs available, etc. Then I will continue on. If not, we'll pick up Thursday with the continuation of this series. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening, and I hope all of you took judicious notes, because I've already alluded to 9 terms on purpose tonight from the Mystic Life of Jesus, Mystery Babylon audio series, The Lost Light, etc. Let's see if you caught on to them, ladies and gentlemen. And if you email me during this broadcast this evening, 12th of January, 2010, tonight, during the broadcast, I will send you some scans right out of some plate drawings from Mr. Lewis and the Rosicrucians of the Great Pyramid that will blow your mind.